People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Not everyone can say that the word pioneer appears in their short bio. For David Smith, founder and chairman of Recap Real Estate Advisors and founder of the global nonprofit Affordable Housing Institute, the term's well deserved. David develops new business services and relationships for Recap. He's led the way throughout his career in both private housing finance transactions and government policy innovations, including mark-to-market restructuring, acquisition and repositioning, equity takeout, and renewed affordability. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing, David Smith will be sharing his insights on current and potential initiatives to improve the nation's affordable housing health. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
David, let's start by taking a look at the predictions that you were making about 5 years ago. Did you anticipate the bubble bursting?
Yes, but nowhere near as much as it did. Indeed, we did some strategic planning at Recap in the summer and fall of 2005, and I concluded that we were in for difficult times, but I didn't know when. Of course, my prediction was somewhat like Mark Twain's famous prediction about Mr. Twain, do you think it will stop raining? And he said, it always has. So in 2005, it didn't take any particular genius to see that things were going to be difficult. And indeed, I wrote a blog post, which with the benefit of hindsight looks like I called the top, but I didn't act on it anywhere near as decisively as I should have, although at least we moved ourselves out of the way of the immediate harm. What I did not see, and didn't, I don't think anybody saw, was the extent to which the phenomenon represented a global phenomenon tied to many more factors than have been written, of which I'll cite only one for illustration, and that is the desire of pension funds from California to Germany to support unsustainable defined benefit pension schemes by making ever more optimistic assumptions about what income-producing assets would generate for real yields. And the effect of all of that, to put it in simple terms, was to put a lot of capital going into real estate and structured finance investments, which drove down risk sensitivity and then led to that moment when everything went upside down and the multi-trillion dollar global problem we're currently facing.
So as budget deficits continue to grow on the federal, state, and local levels, do you anticipate an increasing shortage of low-income housing?
Well, there's certainly going to be less affordable housing production in the U.S. The thing to understand, though, about the way, frankly, that you phrased the question is that affordable housing or the need to create sustainable affordable housing is not a temporary phenomenon. It is a chronic condition of urbanization and growing economies and growing land markets. And the reason is very simple. In any given population, 20%, 25% will have the lowest incomes. And because the price of housing in urban environments rises and falls based on the income of the average person, the bottom quartile is always left behind. And so unless you have an infinitely expandable supply, i.e. infinitely expandable land, land prices rise. As land prices rise, housing prices rise. As housing prices rise, the bottom quartile is left behind. So what that means is when the economy is good and people are making more money, housing prices run away from us. When the economy is bad and housing prices, whether rental or ownership, come back toward us, unfortunately, incomes then fall. So there's always a gap. The gap can only be closed either by the creation of unacceptably long commutes or substandard housing, often known as slums, or by the government intermediating the gap with cash or non-cash incentives. So it's relatively easy to prove, punchline, that in an urban environment like the United States, The government always has to have a role in creating a continuing supply or preserving existing affordable housing, because otherwise the housing that you will get will either be unaffordable or unavailable or unacceptable.
But isn't there still a lot of play depending on where the budgets of the federal, state, and local governments are falling at any given time? In other words, when the deficits are greater, the safety net that the government can provide is going to be less.
Yes. Affordable housing is a public good or a social good. It has a cost in terms of effective implied subsidy per home created. The cost can be larger or smaller. And so the number of units one wants to create or the number of families one wants to assist is essentially determined by how much money the government wants to put against that. When a government is affluent, when the budget is in balance, it has more money it can spend for those things. Obviously, in the United States, we have unsustainable deficits. We have to cut them. Whether we cut them for this purpose, whether we cut them by raising taxes or cutting expenditures is secondary. All affordable housing resources are likely to be squeezed. And the one of most significance that people don't talk about being squeezed is going to be the mortgage interest deduction, which you may not realize costs the United States taxpayers over $100 billion annually. It's three times the HUD's budget, and it's the biggest tax expenditure there is, and it goes to the middle and upper middle class, and it needs to be curtailed and modified, and pressure of deficits is going to do that.
Not in an election year.
Not in an election year, but that's the thing about elections. They have consequences.
Right. In a recent article, David, you analyzed the political challenges that confronted California's redevelopment agencies and said that their demise was inevitable. You were right, of course, on that one. Now that they have been...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks. Stop making predictions, please.
Yeah, now, I remember what happened to that nice lady in Troy who predicted that the Greeks would be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so
we should
go
all
ahead.
Take a lesson. Well, now that the redevelopment agencies have been eliminated, how do you think localities go about meeting low-income housing and community revitalization needs?
Well, the first thing you have to do is broaden your definition of what affordable means. Once upon a time, affordable housing meant people at 80% of area median income or less living there. That was the original definition. That's the definition that even today is in public housing. And it was the definition that was good enough for Lyndon Johnson. Then in 1986, we said affordable housing means people at 60% of median income. So we focused further. In the 5 years before we started going upside down on LIHTC pricing and the like in 2006 and 2007, affordable meant 50% of AMI or 30% of AMI. Now, for people who don't necessarily connect to percents of AMI, a family of four with one wage earner working full-time, making the minimum wage, all right, makes something like about 25 to 28% of median income, okay? And that's a very poor person, a very poor family of four. As we have narrowed the focus of what constitutes affordable housing, the amount of subsidy, the gap we talked about a second ago, has gotten progressively larger. So we've had to put more and more resource into fewer and fewer apartments. We did that in California with redevelopment agencies, which essentially channeled money that would otherwise gone to the state and made it available as soft money that could go into deals. That has to be, with that source gone and never coming back, it has to be reversed. So there have to be higher income limits, reductions in deep targeting, cutting of the optional features that had been added to affordable housing. So green is good, but we can't do as much of it as we wanted before. Social services are good, but we can't do as much of it as we wanted it before. In short, you go back to a vision that says we're going to produce quality standard apartments aimed at people who are blue-collar workers, and we're going to try to get those infused into growing cities. That helps you because it helps you distinguish between a housing cost problem and a poverty problem. I mean, some people are just poor, and poverty is not solved by giving them inexpensive housing. It's solved by raising their income. And then within the poverty problem, there are some people who have a poverty problem, and there are some people who have a behavioral or a household independence problem. And you have to separate those. But housing has classically carried both the poverty problem and the behavioral problem and has not been paid for it.
Do you think HUD's proposed privatization of certain portions of public housing should eventually be expanded to encompass all public housing?
Yes. The public housing system is one of the few relics of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal that is largely unchanged from the way it was created back in the late 1930s, early 1940s. It's a system of, I've called it economic serfdom. Housing authority cannot finance. It cannot borrow. It has a subsidy structure that makes it virtually impossible to produce positive net operating income. It cannot cross-collateralize its portfolio. It cannot sell properties. It's hobbled six ways to Sunday. And, by the way, the rent structures embedded in public housing are well below market standards. So absolutely, yes, it should eventually be expanded to all public housing. I've been calling for this, variations of this, for 6 years. But the key is that in that process of stock transfer or non-profitization, as one might say, one cannot let the federal government get away with paying what it has currently been paying, because what it has been currently paying has been starving the inventory, and retrospectively validating starvation is not a good idea.
We recently interviewed Ken Marchingo from Australia, where they are pretty quickly privatizing their entire public housing stock with nonprofit providers. I'm wondering if you've encountered any efforts overseas through your work with the Affordable Housing Institute that you think could be applied in the United States.
Very much so. Part of the reason that I'm so adamant that the public housing system has to change, aside from the fact that the current delivery system is failing the inventory and failing the nation. And I say that not being critical of the people who work in it. If you work in a horrible system, you're doomed to fail. But the second reason is that what we're talking about here has already been done in England. It's called stock transfer. And it was a Margaret Thatcher invention. Starting in 1988, the Thatcher government allowed essentially residents of what they call council housing, what we call public housing, to vote by plebiscite on whether they wished to secede from being public housing and instead set themselves up as, let's say, an independent nonprofit, essentially rental cooperative. I'm oversimplifying, but you get the idea. The UK has a very large population of effective nonprofit, long-standing, highly professional housing associations. And so this business of stock transfer has had the effect over the 24 years it's been in the law in the UK of taking a little more than half of their public housing and nonprofit privatizing it in a manner similar to what I believe Australia is doing. In fact, my guess is that the Australians went and looked at UK stock transfer. It has had a significant revitalizing effect on the UK inventory. I don't think any UK property that went through stock transfer has regretted it and gone back. And so, yes, it's exasperating to me as an American that there is a British example that is better and more forward-looking than what we have done, but that's the fact.
Have there been any U.S. efforts that you've recommended overseas through the Affordable Housing Institute?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, people come to I constantly get calls or emails at AHI about the following things. One, Community Reinvestment Act. Nobody else in the world has a law which so effectively connects the banking sector to housing affordability. It's one of our most successful experiments. It's obsolete. It was enacted in 1977, you know, well before we had FedEx, much less the internet. And so the delivery model and the scoring model has some, you know, anachronistic elements to it. But CRA, generally speaking, works. It's created knowledge transfer, capital transfer, It's fostered the development of community development banking and CD lending. It works. Nobody else in the world has one as effective as ours. South Africa has something called the Financial Sector Charter. India has something called Priority Sector Lending. Both of those are promising. Other nations should have a CRA. That's one that people are very interested in. Inclusionary zoning. The idea that as you develop property, well-located property, if it's going to include a residential component, a portion of that residential component should be reserved for low income. I've recommended that be used in places as foreign and un-American as, for example, California, where to my astonishment, it does not exist. But inclusionary zoning in the form I'm describing is used in the UK and it's used in Ireland. There's a variant of it that's also used in, of all places, Bombay in India, where in addition to the inclusionary zoning, you get upzoning. And to go back to your comment about how we might create additional affordability, suppose you said to San Jose or San Diego, to take two cities that recently did something innovative on the pension side, suppose you said to them, all right, ladies and gentlemen, or suppose the governor of California said, we're going to pass a statute in California that says every city in California, every city and town in California should have 10% affordable housing. And to the extent it does not, if a developer proposes a scheme to develop a site with residential and includes 25% affordable housing in that scheme, then the developer gets a density bonus of X amount, which density bonus overrides local NIMBYist density and zoning. Well, the effect of that would all of a sudden be to motivate every city in California to find a way to make sure it was getting to 10% affordable housing. What I'm describing has existed in Massachusetts for 38 years. It's called Chapter 40B, and it has been responsible for injecting low-income housing into high-income suburbs that had previously used exclusionary zoning like two-acre lots and big setback requirements and so on. So CRA, inclusionary zoning, and the other one people ask about endlessly is investment tax credits, like the low-income housing tax credit or the historic tax credit. Ironically, the places that could best use them, like the UK and Ireland, for one reason or another, haven't. But yeah, those are things that everybody elsewhere in the world asks about as being of interest to them as American, if you will, intellectual exports.
The low-income housing tax credit's been very effective in recent years. Why is it more effective than direct subsidy?
It's a different kind of money with better features from the government's point of view. Let's take the obvious one, okay? It's pay for performance and 100% risk transfer. What those economics words mean is the following. If you go do an appropriated program, you, a sponsor, go promise to do something for government. Government writes you a check. You spend the money, dig a hole in the ground, put a property up, or don't. Okay? With tax credits, you go to the government. The government gives you a coupon that can be redeemed for future cash at some point. You take that coupon, which is not money, it's just a piece of paper, and you go sell it to a bank for cash. You take the cash the bank gives you. You dig a hole in the ground. You build a project. If the project fails, so we have two examples. In both cases, let's assume the project fails. In case one, the government is out money. In case two, the government is not out money. The bank is out money.
So you've spread the risk.
I've transferred the risk. I, as the government, have transferred the risk from me to the private sector. Now, I've paid for that risk by taking a discount, because when the coupon is redeemed, it's a dollar, whereas the coupon was sold for 92 cents. Well, okay, you know, I might be willing to take an 8% discount not to have a dead hole in the ground. Risk transfer is the first thing. It's not duplicate, cannot be replicated with any appropriated program. Second one that makes a lot of sense, outcome compliance. HUD handbook is 5 inches thick. Tax credit, it's a joke. How many HUD people does it take to run the largest housing program in the United States? Answer, zero. Because it's run out of the Treasury, and it takes only five people in the Treasury. Why? Because the compliance is, did you build it? Did you occupy it with the right people, and did you charge them the right rents? Doesn't ask how you did it. Doesn't ask the process. Just says, did it work? Did you comply? Outcome compliance is very easy to administer and very clear. Did the football go through the goalposts? Was it a field goal or not? And that's possible because you have the risk transfer, because that's the third part. You have collectible recapture. You did it wrong. The IRS issues a piece of paper. They send it to Wells Fargo. They send it to Citibank, and they collect from Citibank. Okay? Risk transfer, outcome compliance, collectible recapture, they're distinctive features of the fact that you're paying with a tax credit, not cash. They cannot be replicated with appropriated programs, and they're why, for all of its features and flaws and complications, they're why the low-income housing tax credit has been operationally the most successful housing program we've ever created.
I'm speaking with David Smith, chairman of Recap Real Estate Advisors and founder of the global nonprofit Affordable Housing Institute. David, can you give an overview of the national foreclosure situation and how it might provide some relief for affordable housing?
Sure. And I'm going to start in an odd place. Between 5 years ago and now, approximately 3.5 million American households disappeared. Well, where did they go? Because housing is not occupied by people exactly. It's occupied by households. 5 years ago, we had 3.5 million more households than we do today. Where did they go? They went, they doubled up, they tripled up, they moved back with their parents, and so on and so forth. We combined households. We shrank households. It was the shrinking of those households that has had the effect of creating whatever the number is, 3.5 million empty homes. Okay? Unless we are dealing with a Detroit or a Cleveland where you actually have to plow the homes under and bury them, which they're doing. Both of those cities are shrinking. We have to find a way to coax the people who used to be independent households out of being multiple family households back into being consumers. We have to do that, by the way, without expecting them to make a large down payment, because they don't have a down payment to make. Their credit's been damaged. So what we have to do is we have to take the empty real estate, change its tenure, change the legal form by which someone occupies it, from homeownership to something else, and make it cheap enough as an occupancy cost, a monthly occupancy cost, for people to move back in. And you can do that, but you want to do that. When you do that, you want to do it in a way that motivates the person who moves back in to care about the housing and to improve it. So you want to give that person confidence, what's called in the trade security of tenure, controllable occupancy cost, and a reasonable expectation that one day they will once again be the owner. So that leads you to rent to own or lease to buy. It leads you to shared appreciation or shared ownership. Both of these forms, by the way, have been used in the UK. They're also ironically being used in Abu Dhabi, which had a significant collapse of its residential real estate market. So the bottom line is that we have to find ways to reoccupy those houses by people who used to own them as homeowners, who now own them as potential future homeowners, and who are motivated to pay the rent, protect the property, cut the grass, take out the trash. That's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to be facilitated, if it happens, by the federal government and by allowing the price of these things to clear. But it's got to be done, because the homes are built. You're not going to plow them all down. We're never going to make this country work if we don't get those 3.5 million households back to being independent households. And we have to essentially economically lubricate their reoccupancy, because they got burned by becoming homeowners at the wrong time.
A recent study by a UCLA professor that was presented to the California legislature showed that job growth and single-family foreclosure are not necessarily happening in the same place. which makes it hard to see how foreclosed single family can be the only solution for affordable housing in this state. We are already seeing the pressure on the rental markets in Silicon Valley. Rents in the last year alone are up by 18%. So if the goal is to move people closer to work, it seems that some new production of affordable housing in high job growth areas really has to be part of the solution. So my question for you is, what policy and or funding changes should be made to help solve this problem?
I'm going to quarrel with your premise.
Okay.
You did fine up until you said moving people closer to work. Which is easier to move, a house or a job?
I'm thinking house.
How do I move a house?
Okay. So you're saying telecommuting.
No. I'm saying that you have to find ways. Yes, you can telecommute. And yes, the intertubes are going to help us. But I'm also saying that I don't look at it like Silicon Valley is creating a lot of jobs. I look at it like the rest of California isn't creating jobs. The Inland Empire, which is a place I've done some work and have been to a bunch of times, even though I haven't lived there, measured by the normal things you would consider quality of life, the Inland Empire is a much better place to live than South Texas. And yet South Texas creates many more jobs than the Inland Empire does.
Doing what?
Doing tech jobs, you know, Dell jobs, service jobs, all kinds of jobs. California ranks 50th out of 50 states in terms of business climate and has ranked 50th out of 50 states for 8 years running. The problem is not that there are too many houses in the Inland Empire. It's that there aren't enough jobs in the Inland Empire. And California's rate of job creation, generally speaking, is not so good. The Silicon Valley area is the only counterexample that I know of within the state of California where there is growth. And so I'm turning it around. I mean, there is one part which says we ought to be creating more rental housing. Rental housing grows the economy because it facilitates labor mobility, whereas home ownership inhibits labor mobility. And societies that have too high a level of home ownership have this problem of labor that is fixed in place because people literally cannot afford to move to where the jobs are. But that said, California is a really big state. If California's job creation were different, then the problem in the Inland Empire would dry up very quickly. The overhang of underwater houses would dry up very quickly.
It would seem to me that it would be a lot cheaper to create jobs in these areas like the Inland Empire than it would be in Silicon Valley, right?
Yes, it would. And in other states and in the interstate battles for job creation, you look at things like 5 and 10 year real estate tax exemptions. You look at industrial bond financing and the kinds of incentives that are used to lure businesses from one place to another. Certainly, you see in the Rust Belt and in the Southeast, you see states and cities very much competing to attract business. But yes, I mean, I think the Inland Empire, again, to take the specific example, I think it has excellent infrastructure. The highways are good. The climate is good. It's not overbuilt. It doesn't have dead spots, traffic-wise or otherwise. It would seem to me to be a very natural and logical place for job creation. Now, as I recall, Proposition 13 complicates the ability of localities to offer those kinds of tax or other kinds of incentives. But, I mean, California needs an economic development program much more than it needs anything else. I mean, that's the only way that you're going to clear the overhang of inventory in places that was already built.
California needs a lot.
California does need a lot.
It does. Final question for you. What are some initiatives that you're currently focused on and what have been the results so far?
The thing that I'm most cranked up about right now is what's called in the trade pay for success, or sometimes called social impact bonds. And we call it by another name, but for this I'll call it social impact bonds. And I'm going to zero in on service enrichment of elderly property. I'm going to explain – it's going to take a second to explain this idea, but I think it is well worth your listeners' time. Right now, we have lots of elderly affordable housing, and we move people into them when they're 62 years of age or older, And most of the people who move in are single. Most of them are widowed. Most of them are women. And we want them to live there and age in place and become a community and be independent. But of course, as they age, they become, they move a little slower. They have more arthritis problems. They gradually become frail. And so as they age in place, the community changes and they need more support. And the support they need is not intensive stuff. It's light stuff like Medicaid management, medication management, a little bit of nutrition, a little bit of cognitive stuff, exercise, all that sort of thing. And if you do those things, people are happier. Their lives, they live longer lives. They're independent more. They're more animated. They have a stronger community. And, oh, by the way, they don't go to the hospital. They don't go to a nursing home. They don't die, to put too fine a point on it. And so you'd like to create a way to service enrich that environment. You'd like to retrofit that property so that services can be added into it. But you can't do that right now under the silo-based system that we have. Those kinds of services are paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. So what you want to do, just like with LIHTC, where you low-income housing tax credits, where you use the private sector to span a time domain. Imagine if the state of California entered into an agreement with an affordable housing sponsor of elderly properties that said, if you can reduce the rates at which these old people go to the emergency room, get hospitalized, get admitted to nursing homes, if you reduce those below our baseline, then after the fact, we will pay you an incentive based on the cost savings. That's a true pay-for-success contract. If you took that contract, which is a contingent pledge by the government to pay in the future, and sold it in the capital markets under a financial instrument, then you could pay the money to do the preventive services that would make the people healthier and happier and reduce the cost of incidents. The financial instrument that I'm describing is commonly known as a social impact bond. We're working with the Enterprise Foundation to create this around the concept of affordable housing in what I call NOES properties, naturally occurring service-enriched properties. Done right, it is a win for the people, it's a win for the property, it's a win for the state, it's a win for everybody, but it requires reinventing the delivery system and the contractual models and a whole series of things that right now are heavily siloed with concrete government silos. So in answer to your question, when we started this discussion, you described me as a pioneer. Well, one of the descriptions of a pioneer is it's a fellow with his face in a puddle and an arrow in his back. we have not succeeded yet in making these things work, but I'm still out there in the wilderness, and we are going to make them work.
I am very impressed. David, that was terrific. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us and for all the work that you do.
Well, you're welcome. I do this because I care about it, and I get up every morning and keep caring about it. And I'm not quite sure why I care about it, but I've been doing it for 36 years, so it's too late to stop caring about it.
Well, we're all glad that you do.
Thank you very much.
David Smith, founder and chairman of Recap Real Estate Advisors and founder of the global nonprofit Affordable Housing Institute. Thanks so much for joining us today. For information and to hear prior episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast, please visit edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.